All right, welcome back. So tonight we're going to start exploring this second aspect of dependent origination, and that is what's called transcendental dependent arising, and explore how this is really related to dependent origination and also how it becomes another map for liberation. And to simplify it, it comes down to what we explored in the meditation. That each moment of suffering, we have the choice of how we relate to it. We can relate to it in a way that creates and generates more suffering, future suffering, more suffering in this moment. Or we can relate to it in a way that leads to less suffering, to the cessation of suffering. And this is what the transcendental dependent origination is teaching. So as you recall, dependent origination has these 12 links that have this basically this generation of self, of selfing, of creating this sense of self, and which is synonymous with creating suffering. And it goes this cycle from ignorance to suffering, back to ignorance, and continues on and on. And so the Buddha focused on the conditionality, as we spoke about last week, how each link is dependent upon the previous link, and how they have this momentum that goes on. And sometimes in the suttas, the Buddha would teach it backwards. So instead of going forwards from, for example, from Vedana, from feeling tone to craving to clinging to becoming to birth to death, he would go from death to birth to becoming and go backwards. So aging and death is a condition of birth. A birth is a condition of becoming. So to kind of make this more concrete, my family, when we relax, sometimes we watch the Great British Baking Show. So there's all the, basically it's a bake-off that these contestants are baking these cakes and different strange things, and they get judged at the end. And so you see this whole process of what they go through and things they forget and their failures and their successes. And so maybe this is why this analogy or simile of a baked cake, a finished cake, comes to mind. That a finished cake, when you see it and you're about to eat it, is dependent upon it being frosted well. And that frosting is dependent in turn on having a well-baked cake, which again, of course, is dependent upon it being put in a hot oven. And the hot oven's dependent upon a well-mixed batter being put into it. And that well-mixed batter depends on the right ingredients, and the ingredients depends on a container. So we take each step, the end result, and we can back it up. And sometimes this is very helpful to do in our practice. When we wake up in the midst of a moment of suffering, a moment of anxiety, of worry, of fear, and step back and say, okay, what was the link that led to this? What was the thought? What was the memory? What was the input from the world, from another person, that set off this whole cycle of suffering? And sometimes that gives us this objectivity to start to see, oh, this is a causal thing. This is conditioned based on what's arising. So just like the cake, without any of those steps, there's no cake at the end. The thing falls apart. If you did everything right but forgot to turn the oven on, if you forgot one of the key ingredients like the yeast or the rising agent, there was no cake at the end. So in an example of a cake, it's a fragile mechanism that we have to do everything right. Unfortunately, for this process of dependent origination, it's quite robust. It has a lot of momentum. It's almost self-perpetuating. It takes a lot of energy to start to see through it. So starting with dependent origination, starting with the sense of death and suffering that comes from that, we start to work backwards from that. If we didn't take birth, there'd be no death. If there's no becoming, there'd be no birth. If there's no clinging, there's no becoming. If no craving, no clinging. If no feeling tone, no craving. So each link we can start to step back and look more clearly, and perhaps releasing our momentum into that, our momentum, our engagement, our grasping around that. So wherever you find yourself, you can use this approach, this technique. You know, ever since middle school, I remember this one day, for some reason, I was in this cafeteria waiting in this long line to get one of those middle school greasy cafeteria pizzas, like squares, really. And a song, we had a jukebox, and someone put a song on. And that song and the smell and taste of that pizza are just linked in my mind. So whenever that song arises, there's this whole memory, this whole, you know, feeling tone that arises with that. It's like it's so linked and so connected. But when I'm in the middle of being triggered in that way, if I step back and realize it was because I heard that song. If I didn't hear that song, that wouldn't arise. A very simple way of looking at this, if there's this, then there's that. If there's not this, then that doesn't arise. So the Buddha would walk backwards from the sense of suffering to see how these steps are linked. He also walked back from liberation to show how each of those cycles is also linked. And this is what is known as the transcendental dependent origination. And you see it particularly in the sutta, the Upanisa Sutta from the Sanna Nikaya number 1223. So it's also translated as the prerequisites or the discourse on supporting conditions. And in this sutta, the Buddha starts with liberation and works backwards to ignorance. So he takes the 12 links of transcendental origination and then combines it with the 12 links of dependent origination. So you got 24 links. So that's, you know, that's a lot for any human mind to try to hold all at once. And I'm not going to try to go through that in much detail. But I do want to pull out three key links that really, I think, illustrate this whole process of going from suffering to liberation. Focus on the first and second links and one of the middle links. Now, so if you go back to going through the forward direction in the cycle. Now, what's interesting, the very first link in this transcendental origination is the last link, independent origination. Okay, so last link, as you recall, is death and the suffering that arises from that. So that suffering, that very first link in the transcendental dependent arising, what leads to our freedom is suffering. The first link is suffering. And now, interesting, because usually suffering leads to more ignorance, more blindness. This is the cycle of dependent origination, that our suffering, we misinterpret it. And in that way, we start to reinforce our ignorance because we're not seeing how things actually are. It's like this, the song that goes, looking for love in all the wrong places. You know, we're seeking love. We're seeking a sense of deep satisfaction, a sense of happiness and freedom and ease in our lives. And we look for it in places that are ultimately incapable of providing that, of creating that environment. We don't see it, and we still try and try. We look for what's substantial and what is inherently unsubstantial. We look for something that's permanent in what is inherently impermanent. And we look for a solid sense of self, a sense of me, in something that's inherently empty. And we do this again and again because there is this sense of ignorance, of blindness, of delusion that drives this whole process. And we're not seeing things how they actually are. So we can look at dependent origination and see this cycle, how this ignorance, this begins this chain of events that leads to birth, death, and suffering. And we're really caught in this cycle. And then not like baking a cake, which, you know, is kind of a delicate process. Again, this has a robustness. It has a momentum to us. We're actually much more trapped in it. We have almost an unconscious momentum to stay caught in it. Because everything is reinforcing that quality of ignorance. It's continuing the cycle. So you think about the many kinds of births that we take. You know, the births in our large roles in our lives, you know, times when we're growing up and then maybe we get married or find a life partner and then we have a child, or maybe we get divorced, or maybe we're single. There's all these roles that we go through. It's constantly changing. Or in the many moments of small births during the day, when we have that irritation, birth of an irritated person, or the birth of someone who's excited and happy, constantly coming forth. So myriad types of births, but they all reinforce ignorance. They all reinforce this quality of ignorance and continuing the cycle. That's why in the pit of origination, this first link is often portrayed as a blind person, the ignorance. So it's not about, you know, whether someone has sight or not. It's about how we don't see things how they actually are. And this is really a metaphor for how we move through life, not seeing life clearly. We see through our ideas and impression of life, of what we think life should be. This includes our prejudice, our biases, this whole spectrum of how we create suffering for ourselves and for those around us. There's just a basic misunderstanding of the nature of life. This is the definition of ignorance. This is the definition of what ignorance creates, the cycle of suffering. And this is where transcendental dependent origination comes in. And I enjoyed seeing this. It was surprising to see that. The very first link is suffering. And this is this choice point that if we follow our momentum, our habit, our unconscious tendency, we go right back into the cycle of suffering. But we take this other link, this other step, then we launch into this new cycle that leads to liberation. It's actually not a cycle, I'd say, one-way direction. And the second link after suffering in transcendental dependent origination is faith. Is faith. Now, faith in the Buddhist world, we don't often talk very much about, at least in this Western interpretation of Buddhism. But faith, you know, is such a fundamental part of so many religions and so many spiritual traditions. And so faith and suffering, how interconnected are they? Because our suffering is very familiar. You know, we know it. We know it very well. And perhaps it's one of the things we know the most about ourselves is how we suffer, the patterns of our suffering, how we get triggered here, we get reactive there, how we lose and grieve our beautiful parts of our lives, how we find things falling away. And so it takes tremendous faith to do something different than to follow that cycle, to follow our blindness. Because we much prefer the familiar. We prefer what is known, what we've experienced. Going into what's unknown, it takes this act of faith because it scares us. It goes, we realize we have to give up something very fundamental in who we take ourselves to be. We realize and sense that the whole assumptions of who ourselves we are, who the other is, who the world is, has to be reevaluated, has to be transformed. And faith is needed because we still have this blindness. We're still in the midst of seeing through our delusion, our misunderstanding. And yet we hear or sense that there is another way. We hear the Dharma, we hear a teaching. Maybe we just see someone that inspires us. Maybe we see nature that inspires us. We sense that there's another way. This is the welling up of faith. Or perhaps we've exhausted every other possibility. And we've tried this way, we've tried that way. We've tried to will ourselves to awakening. We've tried to suffer and fight and deal, overcome. And we have to find the limitations of this. This is the trickster types of teaching, the teaching that of some traditions were actually ultimately meant to fail, that we try until we can't realize our will can't take us there. And then we discover the path. And sometimes as humans, we have to learn it this way. We have to learn through our failures, through our mistakes, till we finally go the only place we haven't gone, and that's to faith, to surrender. Perhaps, you know, many of us have done that exercise called a trust fall, when you're standing upright with your eyes closed with a group of trusted friends or people behind you, and you just fall backwards. One of the most scariest things to do as a human being, because we don't want to hit the back of our heads. And those people catch you as you're falling. But there's this trust, this moment where you let go control of your own uprightness, of your own gravity, and you trust that something will catch you and save you. And this is the faith, as we go from our belief in our delusion, our belief that if I keep trying harder and harder, if I get that right relationship, the right possession, then I'll finally be happy. And how often do we have to do that till we finally try something different? And so this trust, this surrender, this is really trusting in the Dharma, in this expression of spirituality. There's many different expressions, but perhaps the archetype carries across whatever spirituality that we find our heart lands in. So in the Dharma, trusting in the Dharma, trusting in the refuges. This is the expression of taking refuge. That the suffering is so much that we take refuge that this is another path through. Now this is then the second step. First step is suffering, then faith. Once we have that faith starts to grow in us, then there's a sense of joy that arises, that there's a possibility that is can bring that quality of joy, of that I don't have to suffer, that there is hope. And then from that point, the transcendental dependent origination starts to unfold through meditative practices, starts to unfold through particularly the development of concentration. And there's a particular sequence that the Buddha often laid out. Now, concentration, we'll explore that a little bit here tonight. And we'll also explore how it's not the only way for our practice to deepen. Now, from joy, there's a sense of trying to meditate, to actually turn our attention toward our experience, toward meeting our breath, to meeting our sensations, and learning to find that steadiness of attention. Now, in doing that, we very quickly start to be confronted with the hindrances, the quality of craving, of aversion, of sleep, sloth, and torpor, of restlessness and worry, of doubt. They start to be these almost powers that come up in front of us, in between us and our practice. And how we work with those is often, this is part of what happens with dependent origination. The next stage after joy is what's called rapture or pity. And this it's not rapture as we might sometimes think of it. It's that sense of an energetic intensity that can have a wide range of expressions. This is some of the bells and whistles as meditators that we might be sitting and feel there's just this upwelling of energy in our bodies, intense sensations of energy. And what's happening is we're starting to unhook from the hindrances. We're trying to almost withdraw symptoms as we detox from the power of the hindrances. And we keep getting pulled that way. We're learning to stay still. And there's this tremendous energy that starts to move through our system, because we're not moving with the tendency toward the hindrances, of relating from the hindrances. Now, eventually this intense energy starts to shift into find a quality of balance and becomes what's called tranquility, a sense of more of a calmness. And then from that calmness, we start to find this balance of joy and tranquility, which leads to the next link, which is happiness. I'm just kind of glossing over these middle links. And these all lead to concentration, samadhi, right? So suffering, instead of leading to ignorance, leads to faith. Faith then leads into our deepening of our practice. The steadiness of our attention grows and grows to the point where our minds become concentrated, or samadhi. Now, classically, samadhi is also known as the jhana states. And these are absorption states or trance states, Or is it a quality of deep concentration on one object that everything else falls away? Okay. These concentration states are tricky because in the midst of them, they feel very profound. They feel very deep, very peaceful. It feels like you've awakened, you've arrived. Because there's also this sheltering, your mind is literally shelter from the hindrances, shelter from the craving, the wanting, the sleepiness, the restlessness and worry. But the Buddha was very clear that the hindrances themselves are dukkha, that they are impermanent. They are subject to change. They're not lasting. If you read the history of the Buddha before he became awakened, before he became the Buddha, he actually studied, he sought different masters of meditation, and he actually mastered two different schools to the point where the teacher said, you know, you should start to co-teach with me because you've really mastered the technique. And the Buddha looked at those techniques and realized that they still were lacking, that they still were impermanent. They weren't the liberation that he was seeking, his one-pointed seeking over these 6 years. Because when we're in those states, we're sheltered, we're so absorbed in this one quality that our minds are very steady, very quiet, very peaceful. But there's not enough, there's not much happening. There's not the arising experience. There's not the arising of the hindrances in the mind states. And the arising of those combined with our steadiness is where insights arise. The arising of our struggle, the rising of identification, met with a steadiness of a mind, is what leads to insights. So we need enough concentration. We need enough steadiness of mind, a firmness of mind to be able to see clearly. But the jhana states themselves, we don't need to go into those. We actually, even in the classic tradition, we go to what's called the pre-jhana, or the access concentration, which allows us to see. Because what we're dealing with is trying to pierce through this fog of our confusion, the fog of our ignorance, as I mentioned last week, and how that creates the world that we view, that we see, that we experience, the world that we project upon others, the world we project upon ourselves. Samadhi is one way to gather enough energy to start to pierce through that, to see through that. Another is investigation and inquiry, supported by a certain level of steadiness of attention. And this is really my training, my tradition, as I've learned from Rodney. It's not going into the jhanas, but going into the quality of investigation. And it needs a depth of sincerity, a depth of interest to be able to see through the delusion. Now, those of you who have participated in the dyads that we do sometimes, when one person is asking the same question again and again for 5 minutes, and then one person just responds, seeing what depth comes out with each repetition of the question. Some of you may have noticed that that can drop you into a deep state of concentration and stillness, like you're in the middle of a long retreat, that suddenly that repetition, that constant investigation, that reminder that your partner provides, allows you to deepen, to connect very, very simply and directly and immediately. And often it is very insightful. So 20 minutes of shared intention can feel like you're dropped into the middle of a retreat. So this is a taste of what investigation can offer. Also, again, the main problem is meeting this wall of delusion, this wall of ignorance, this wall of blindness. Another way is through the urgency to see. Just, okay, I've exhausted everything else. There's a couple people in the modern time, Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie, who had tremendous, tremendous suffering in their lives, tremendous depression and tremendous personal pain. They were motivated by their suffering. And through that suffering, they woke up. They woke up very deeply, very profoundly. This is why this is the first link in transcendental dependent origination. So regardless of whether we use concentration or inquiry, investigation, or just the urgency of our heart to learn, to turn toward, we become ripe for insights. And this leads us to the third key link I wanted to talk about. And that's the knowledge and vision of things, how they actually are. So the first key one was simply suffering is the start and how the choice point of suffering going into more suffering or the suffering that goes in toward freedom. Faith, I think, is also a key link in how that faith allows us to go into the unknown. And then from the unknown, it opens us to this journey that eventually we start to see how things actually are. I think this is the third key link of transcendental dependent origination. So in this way, when we start to see things how they actually are, the momentum of our practice, the momentum of our sincerity starts to see through the veil of our delusion. Seeing through our ignorance, you see the three characteristics, the actual nature of dukkha, of impermanence, and of anatta, of non-self. The blindness is starting to leave. The blindness is starting to fade at this point. In some ways, this is the key link. This is the key link that once that starts to arise, we start to see things how they actually are, there's no turning back. We may still have this momentum of our conditioning that we have to learn to work with and eventually see through. But once we start to see things how they are, something transforms very deeply in us. And of course, there's conditions that arise to make that link happen, that knowledge of and vision of things as they are. And there's links that come after that. But it's a turning point. It's this turning point, which is very key. Because our energy then starts to orient around what we see it to know to be true. This isn't about intellectual truth. It's not about what you can read in a book or listen in a talk. It's something that you see in the direct reality of your experience. So it's unshakable. This is the insight of seeing things how they actually are. And it becomes a turning point that moves us toward liberation. This is a parallel toward the dependent origination where tanha is a key point. Tanha is when we start to go from just this moment's experience with its sounds, its smells, the quality of being pleasant or unpleasant, and we start to move toward it. We start to move away from it. We start to develop this thirst to have more of it or this thirst to have less of it. This sets us down this slippery slope toward selfing, toward becoming. So in dependent origination, that's the first step toward that suffering, that selfing and suffering. Now in transcendental origination, that's the releasing of that thirst. Because we see things directly as they are. In dependent origination, our blindness, our ignorance is still shaping the way we act. The very way we relate to life. We see something, we think, oh, if I move toward it, that will eventually give me lasting happiness. It'll give me a sense of identity that I can latch onto and hang on the wall and never have it fade. Right? Their ignorance is still operating in tanha. While in transcendental dependent origination, our wisdom is starting to operate. And when something arises, we see it how it actually is. We see it as something that is impermanent. We see it as being inherently unsatisfactory. We see it as being inherently empty of self. So this releasing of that thirst then leads to the last few links of transcendental dependent origin arising. That's a mouthful. So first one is what's called disenchantment. So disenchantment, we just stop. We just become a little less interested. And you may have noticed this in your own life. That things that you used to have so much allure for, so much drive, they kind of lost their tarnish or their shine. They become a little less interesting. Because this growing wisdom in each of our practices is trying to shift how we relate to things. you start to realize I can keep going down that merry-go-round, but eventually that ride's going to have to stop. I will not keep getting that sense of thrill or excitement. There's something else that's starting to come forth. So there's the disenchantment, you know, as opposed to the wanting, the movement toward. And this next link is dispassion. And dispassion, instead of getting more and more engaged as we usually do, we start to find that, okay, our energy doesn't want to go into craving, into wanting. It starts to go into this area of orienting toward the stillness, orienting toward the sense of interconnection. And eventually that develops to the point where there's what's called emancipation and freedom, that we're free from our drives of inadequacy, our drives of longing. And then finally, the final link is the knowledge of the destruction of the cantors, the destruction of the fundamental roots of our ignorance. So I know this is a lot of words, a lot of concepts, but just hopefully to try to frame it in a way that is accessible in summary. That the dependent origination that we've explored this last year, you know, is a cycle from ignorance all the way to births and suffering, and then back. It reinforces itself. So it's a cycle. It goes again and again. This is the cycle that suffering leads to more suffering. This is a famous quote by Ajahn Chah, that there's the suffering that leads to more suffering. But there's also the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And this is where transcendental dependent origination starts. It's with the suffering that's here right now, right here. How do I meet that? Is there a faith that moves into a leap of faith into seeing something beyond our habit pattern, beyond our tried and true way of relating to life? And this starts to lead us to seeing more and more clearly. We develop this capacity to see clearly, to see through the fog of our delusion, to start to see how things actually are. And then from there, we start to act upon that understanding. We start to deepen into it. Our lives start to orient and align around that. So this is the cycle of transcendental dependent origination. And each moment, there's that choice. How do we relate to it? That adds more suffering, or leads to the end of our suffering. All right, if we could just sit quietly for a few moments and let those words settle. All right, so as we move into a chance for a large group discussion, hopefully we can work with this and try to make more sense. I'm going to just paste the homework in for this week and just discuss that for a moment. All right, so this week, reflect on how suffering can reinforce our future suffering. Okay, all this, try to make this very concrete in your life. Make this not so abstract, but how am I relating to this moment of suffering? It could be small suffering, it could be large suffering. It's often easier to practice in the small sufferings, the little irritations, the little bit of a gritchiness. And how do I relate to that in a way in this moment that either amplifies that suffering or starts to dissipate it? And reflect on how I'm relating to it in this moment may condition the future, condition future suffering, or can cultivate wisdom. You know, how can suffering cultivate wisdom? This is the ultimate point of transcendental dependent origination, is how do we relate to our suffering in a way that leads to the end of our suffering. And then finally, what is the role of faith in meditation practice? Okay, see this directly in your life and practice. Looks like I dropped one word. I'll copy it fresh if you want a full copy of that. Yes. Yes. So your life and practice. See it directly in your life and practice. How it shows up in your family life. How it shows up in your work. Going to the grocery store. Driving. You know, whatever. Walking. Whatever you might be doing. Your body's aches. Your mind's hurts. These are all suffering that is an opportunity to turn toward. And hopefully you start to sense how the Buddhist path, he was famous to say that there's just one thing I teach. The Buddha said, I just teach suffering and the end of suffering. Okay, the Four Noble Truths are an expression of that. Dependent origination and transcendental dependent arising is also a teaching of suffering and how the cessation of suffering. All right, so we have a chance now if you have any comments or questions. You're welcome to unmute yourself, or you can raise your virtual blue hand. I may not see you immediately if you're waving your physical hand. A completely clear talk. That's great. Everyone's no confusions at all.
Tim, can I go?
Okay, Dane, go ahead.
Hey, you're talking about...
Wait, hang on a second, Dane.
Nope.
I forgot to plug my earphones in my ears. Okay, go ahead.
You're talking about how the cycles of transcendental dependent origination, that's a lot of words, lead to disengaging and being dispassionate. Do you see that as like leading you more towards a monk style of life or just engaging with the life you're already in differently or maybe somewhere in between on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that certainly the suttas are very monastic oriented. You know, most of the suttas are kind of, that's kind of the framework and that's the kind of the bias of them, if you will. But the disenchantment, dispassion isn't really about what we're doing or not doing in our life. You know, we could do the exact same thing from a place that's really caught in craving and wanting. And it was really the question is selfing is a key piece there. That as I do this, as I'm using it to reinforce my sense of self, or I'm not reinforcing the sense of self. And paradoxically, actually, if we're not reinforcing the sense of self, there's a different quality of engagement and freedom and spontaneity that arises as we engage in life. Because we're not saying, oh, how am I looking? Or am I doing this well enough? Or am I afraid of failing? Or look how great I am. That's not arising. You're just in the midst of actually doing it. This is, you know, we sometimes talk about being in the zone. You're not thinking about that, the goal. You're just in the midst of doing it. You're doing it for the love of doing it. And when that activity is over, then it's like, okay, that was a beautiful activity. And now you're ready to meet whatever's arising next. So that's that disenchantment and dispassion. Because it's easy to kind of misinterpret that means I have to cut off everything I find pleasurable in my life and just become, you know, really pare everything down. And sometimes that's where our hearts are drawn. And sometimes we realize, well, maybe some of that stuff, it's so connected with my craving, my wanting. It is helpful to let that go. There may be different areas of your life that's so intertwined. And there's other areas that you can actually start to see them separated out. And there's often a transition period as we start to not be moved through the cycle of dependent origination. In other words, not being moved through the sense of selfing and this power of ignorance. We're kind of in this limbo place, this kind of no man's land that we're not, the old strategy doesn't make sense anymore. But the new way that moves through us hasn't fully developed, hasn't fully shown up in a way that allows us to actually move with it. So sometimes that's kind of a difficult time for in our practice is more kind of, what am I supposed to do with my life? And then eventually we find something else moves through us. And so the activities of life, it's easy to get distracted by, oh, can't do this or can't do this, that. And sometimes you need to let go of some of those things. But the point is really how you're relating to this moment. And so a good way to practice it is do something that you enjoy doing and see, can I meet this without always referencing the sense of me? Always referencing the sense of self. And see if I can do it as if there was no self. And that I think you might find, especially with things like playing music or being creative or just talking to a loved one, there's a different quality that comes out. Does that help, Dane?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Lauren, go ahead. Lauren, looks like you're still muted.
I was thinking of this process of changing the trajectory of the suffering, and instead of going to more suffering, go towards freedom. And so I'm just imagining, me in my daily life suffering. Well, first I have to realize I'm suffering. So sometimes I don't even realize I'm suffering. So be more attentive to, because you were talking about like the little irritations and things like that, that might be a place to start. So then I know I'm suffering, but I don't know really, usually you don't have the insight at that point. So I'm thinking that those kind of tactics where you, walk with a question, or you just put a question out there and you just let it sit for a while and see what comes. And being in a state of I don't know is probably, it seems like that would be helpful to have a space of allowing myself to be in a space of I don't know. Frequently, if I'm suffering, I'm doing something that I've done many, many, many times. And it often feels like there's no way out. This is just what happens. I always suffer when this happens. And so it seems like I need to have faith to believe that there might be another way. And I don't know the way, so I have to have faith that that could come, the answer to that question could reveal itself. And I know I've had teachers, and probably you have been one of them, that has said, just ask that question and just let it percolate. And that asking questions was a really good way to go when you investigate, So I don't know. I was just trying to envision what would be a practice, a place to start practicing with this.
Yes. Yeah. Those are all good ideas. And it sounds like the asking the question has that worked very well for you?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it has, but it's not like I say I'm going to ask this question. I'm really clear about it. I feel like I want to find out the answer to something, and I just kind of below the surface, and then, more and more is revealed. So Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I asked that is that I think each person, based on your conditioning, your history, you know, just the way your mind's wired, there's different entry points that you can find. And sometimes those entry points change over time. So the way you were talking about that sense of investigation is like you have that quality of suffering come up, especially the ones that you just feel like, okay, I'm always going to suffer in this situation. You can feel the momentum, right, Lauren? You can feel how it just wants to keep going. So you need some way to pause in the middle of that to kind of interrupt it. Because if you don't interrupt it, it's just going to cycle until something else kind of knocks it off its tracks and another form of selfing takes over. So like on, you know, those of you who have been in retreats, you know, this is something that I think Rodney learned from Narayan, and then Narayan and I like to do it when we teach retreats, is when you hear the bell, the temple bell outside calling us back from walking meditation, we have everyone pause. You know, instead of like, oh, I got to hurry to get back to the hall or go to the bathroom, you literally stop whatever you're doing and simply be still. And in that pause, ideally what you do is you notice kind of the momentum that you've been walking with, unconsciously walking with. So when you kind of wake up to the fact, oh, I'm suffering, I don't like this. When you realize I don't like this, that's a beautiful time to bring some kind of pause. So stop whatever impulse that the suffering is wanting you to do. So what, you know, whatever it might be acting out, it might be thinking, it might be talking. Pause and just take a couple breaths, try to find where your body is. And what is your body's experience, right, in that moment of suffering? So use the body as this gateway to really land you in the middle of this moment of suffering. And that's the ideal place to then start to ask, okay, what's present? You know, what am I believing? You know, what is my orientation toward life? I mean, these questions are, the question can show you where your suffering is, where your identification is. Or another question could show you where the release of that identification is. And both can be very helpful. Like for myself, I just often start, like just as I explained, I try to find that place of pause to not buy into the momentum of my mind, the momentum of the papancha, and say, okay, where's the body, right? Where's the body? What's the body experiencing? What's the wisdom of the body showing? There's a big tightness in my gut, you know, my jaw is really tight. You know, I feel like I have to run away from this situation. And then I just try to allow that to be how it is. Just try to feel it. And then I try to see, okay, what's the emotionality here? What's the emotional flavoring or landscape? What's the deeper beliefs around that? And try to see what's the superficial and what's the deeper. Not doing this intellectually, but trying to do it really much in the felt sense of the moment. So that's one way that I found very helpful.
Thank you. I mean, that feels really concrete to me. And I'm going to just take some notes on that. Thank you very much.
How often do you move from suffering? How often do you move in relationship to suffering?
Are you asking?
Yeah, if I'm uncomfortable, I shift. My mind's, you know, I'm getting distracted. I go on the internet. Yeah. Notice how we move based on suffering. And that starts to bring that little bit of that pause into the very movement that suffering that unconsciously drives us. All right. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and mute you, or you can mute yourself.
Oh, yeah.
It looks like Brooke's sending a text.
Tim, we can't hear you.
Things you like to hear. Okay, so can you hear me now? Yeah. Okay, so what else is out there? I just put a link for the sutta if you'd like to look that up.
Tim, I had my hand up.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't see it. Oh, there you are.
Oh, that's okay. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by faith. And maybe that's something that you want us to do in this next week. Maybe that's part of it. But I'm... I'm not sure if you mean blind faith, where I'm just taking someone else's word for it, or if you mean faith that's supported by the fact that a number of things, I've had some experiences that would shore up my belief that, well, I guess these have worked for me, so I guess that will too. Did you want that just to percolate in us, or would you like to chat about what you think of what you mean when you say faith?
Sure. Yeah, Jackie, I would say that it is, mainly I want us to kind of explore that in our own experience, because faith certainly has different things that arise from us. You know, if you're, have a strong religious upbringing, we might have a different relationship to faith than if we didn't, for example. And the main way I'm using faith is, how do we relate to something that's beyond what we know? That's something that's beyond our what's right in front of us or through our experience, that there's this edge that we're kind of going beyond what we've experienced or what we've kind of organized the world around. It can certainly be kind of informed by our past history that, like that trust fall exercise, every time I've let go, they've caught me. So maybe I can let go again, even though it feels like they're not going to catch me. Same thing with our practice. We can relate to the moment completely innocently without having this sense of me having to weigh in. And that can feel scary. But when we have experiences of going through that and actually seeing the deep stillness that's beyond that, that informs our faith. But for me, faith is always, it's beyond what I can fully, know for sure. It's on that edge of what's known. It's going into something beyond. And, sometimes the sense of something much bigger, the sense of the deep stillness, the deep wisdom of the world, you could use the sense of God, if that resonates with you, as something else that you trust, that you have faith in. But I think it's a way of kind of bringing that topic to bear, to kind of percolate through your own experience. And then hopefully next week we can explore that more.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. All right, and Lyndall?
Okay, you can hear me now?
I can.
Great, okay. Well, one of the things that occurred to me when you were talking about the concentration and then entering through investigation with questions and things. But for me also, another way I think about that too is, you know, getting a certain stability of mind, and then that point where we begin to open our attention to just noticing whatever is occurring, you know. So sort of, it's that sort of not necessarily investigating with the question, but more investigating by just actually, you know, noticing the different things that come into the mind or that the body feels and what happens to them and, you know, the suffering that comes up, all of that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a nice way to hold the word investigation. That it's not like, you know, I'm a, you know, investigator that's trying to write down and solve a problem or a mystery. It's much more of that immediate things arising as they will, and it's simply paying attention. Mm-hmm. I often think of investigation as kind of informed mindfulness.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah,
mindfulness opened out to all of the. What, all the four foundations, right?
That's right. Yeah, you can, yeah, exactly. Open to that whole range of body, that whole wide range of body experience, that quality of Vedana, the mind states, the, you know, the hindrances, all these things can be simply held and observed in the middle of that. And as you start to sit in the middle of experience, and things are, it starts to teach you. Mm-hmm. It starts to show you that. Yeah, and so that is a quality of investigation. And I think it's actually a nice articulation of quality we should have regardless. Because mm-hmm. if we get too much into our minds, because the mind's going to want to try to solve and figure and, you know, organize, say, fit everything into its box, which is really just a whole another process of how we, this is part of the, sorry, I'm a little tired this morning or this evening. it's part of the whole process that creates the problem in its first place. It's like that the mind's need to always place everything and organize everything and put everything in its box. And so that's, we can, if we're not careful, our investigation can start to take that form. Ideally, investigation is kind of showing us kind of where that free fall is. And that becomes like, okay, how am I relating to this breath, to this sound, in a way that the ground falls out from under me. Mm-hmm. The more I'm like, I'm the one who's looking and the one who's seeing, the more I'm kind of just observing from a very still place. Mm-hmm. But when you just start to be in the midst of this whole array of things arising, the sense of you starts to get softer and softer. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda, for bringing that up. All right, anyone else?
Tim, I have a quick question. Just reminded me about around that same time you were talking about were you talking about pre-jhanas or something? That come up and then you choose, and then you don't go into the jhanas, but you do the investigation. But what were the pre? Can you restate that?
Well, that's in terms of this transcendental dependent origination. There's this kind of momentum that leads toward the jhanic state. So there's things like joy, rapture, tranquility, cool, and happiness. Those are the, at least in this expression, this is a common cycle or common set of conditions that leads to concentration. And there's each of those words of joy, rapture, tranquility, and happiness have their particular meaning in this Pali or in the Buddhist tradition. But that's said to kind of create the conditions for the mind to then go into those trance states. Mm-hmm. And right at that edge of going into the trance states, there's also the edge of going into insight practice, because you have enough steadiness of attention developed. And, you know, again, that's set, you don't have to necessarily go through. I've never been trained in those particular sets, but as I study them, I recognize them in my practice. So yeah, those are arising. So I think there's some level that it's kind of wired into the human mind to go through some permutation of them. but you don't have to get caught up in ticking off. Okay, I got happiness. Now I can go to joy, and then that's going to take us the wrong direction. Does that get to your question, David?
Yep, I think I just forgot. When you said that again, I remembered, and it will just happen. It's whatever it is. It's not like an order, if I hear what you're saying there.
Yes, yeah, I think, well, there's some traditions that have a much more systematic way of unfolding the practice, and some people follow that very easily or naturally, and others, we have a different way of our minds going, so.
Yeah, it just helps. Yeah, thank you.
All right, so I'll give a minute or two for one more question or a moment or two. All right, I think thank you again for your engagement. I know this is it's a bit heady, this process, but hopefully I gave enough guidance to start to see it really in your life, see where there's suffering. How can I relate to that in a way that leads to less suffering? And then we have Khalid has some announcements. Would you like to do that, Khalid?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Khalid on the Listens Board. And today, here's some announcements. We have on Wednesday the 16th, the Buddhist Essentials class with Suze and Susan from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Then Rodney Smith has a book club on the 16th of December and the 30th at 4 p.m. PST, and that's on dharma.org. I think the newsletter recently had some more details on that. Then in January, we have two intro classes, one with Steve Wilhelm starting on the 12th of January on a Tuesday for 6 weeks, and then Tim is doing an intro class starting on Thursday the 14th for another 6 weeks. Both of those are from 7 to 9 p.m. And then at the end of January, the last weekend, the 30th and 31st, Rodney Smith is doing a weekend retreat from 9 to 4:30 p.m. That's it for the next 2 months.
All right. Thank you, Khalid. All right. So I hope to see you all next week, and we'll have a discussion about this topic and continue exploring it together.